Welcome to the fourth program in Examining Education, a series that focuses on the debates in the field of education. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. Today's topic, like our others, is very timely, as we're currently in the midst of a hot debate about the quality of our teaching force, how much teachers are responsible for student achievement, and what's the best way to measure their effectiveness. The debate has very real implications, as currently the federal government has put the power of money into the equation. Through Race to the Top, a $4.35 billion competitive grant program, the federal government will give money to those states who, among other requirements, reform their teacher evaluation systems. This means moving away from using seniority and tenure, another hot issue, and incorporating research-based measures, adding in particular some measure involving student achievement, another sticky point. The Illinois Senate, for example, as a result of losing the competition for Race to the Top funds, unanimously passed a school reform bill in April of 2011 that did reshape the terms of teacher evaluation. The bill, interestingly, had the support of teacher unions, business, and education reformers. The Gates Foundation is currently funding a multi-year study, Measures of Teacher Effectiveness, MET. The study is investigating what evaluation tools can be used to identify effective teachers. One of the tools that the project is looking at that is particularly controversial is a value-added measure which tries to separate effective from ineffective teachers based on the improvement their students show from one year to the next on scores on standardized tests given by each state. Other assessments involve student questionnaires, teacher observation, and evaluations of their content knowledge. Two of our guests are involved directly in the study. Our third guest has published a sharp critique of the project. Our first guest is Drew Jatomer, distinguished researcher at Educational Testing Service and member of the Gates Foundation project team. Drew has an extensive background in the area of teacher evaluation. He's been involved in the design, development, and research of the National Board Certification process, a process begun in 1987 and meant to improve the quality of teaching by identifying and maybe even helping to cultivate accomplished teachers. Teachers who wish to voluntarily go through a very elaborate and time-consuming year-long procedure in which they submit portfolios with much data about their own teaching. Collecting this data involves them in lots of reflection and analysis of their own teaching and requires them to do extensive writing about and videotaping what goes on in their classrooms. School districts will often encourage teachers to go through this process by offering financial incentives such as pay raises. As of December 2010, 91,000 teachers have gone through this process. Since we have about 3 million K-12 teachers, that's a little less than 3%. Drew's also involved in the development of the Praxis tests. These are national tests administered by ETS and required by most states for certification of new teachers. The standards for what are considered passing grades, by the way, are set by the individual state. Welcome, Drew, and now to my first question. How much responsibility do you think teachers have for student achievement?
I think there's no doubt that teachers have a critical role to play in student achievement. So on the face of it, we go into schools and classrooms with the firm belief that teachers do have an impact on student outcomes. The challenge, I think, for the field is whether we can establish direct causal relationships between a particular teacher and particular student outcomes, and that's a much more dicey proposition.
Some people argue that not only is it difficult to determine how much a particular teacher affects a particular student's achievement, but that teachers have very little effect on student achievement compared to factors such as family background and economic status. What's your own take on this?
Yeah, well, I think the data are pretty clear that, in fact, student outcomes are the largest impact are actually non-school effects. So when we talk about the role of teachers and the data to support the impact, the effects that teachers have on students, we have been able to identify teachers as being able to explain the most variation in student outcomes of all school factors, but that does not suggest that out-of-school factors are not absolutely critical to how students wind up doing academically.
Okay, so you're saying that although factors outside of the school are the most powerful predictors of student achievement, within the school environment, teacher behavior is the most important influence on the student. In my own readings about teacher evaluation, I saw there was a shift from looking at whether there are particular characteristics that identify effective teachers, their academic credentials, personality, kindness, grooming, to looking at whether effective teachers can be identified by particular kinds of teaching behaviors in the classroom. Where are we now?
Right. So when we've looked at factors such as whether people have advanced degrees, when we look at their experience levels after the first few years of teaching, when we look at the kinds of things that have been associated with compensation strategies, we find little or no relationship between that and teacher effectiveness as measured in various kinds of ways. And so the idea is, rather than looking just at these characteristics, what we want to do is look at what teachers do. And one of the things that we've done in our work is we make a clear distinction between teaching quality and teacher quality. Because what we see when we look inside a classroom, whether we look at it through an observation of teachers, whether we look at it in terms of the kinds of achievement gains that students have, we actually have a lens on the kinds of teaching that students experience. But some of that is certainly attributable to the teacher, but there are a whole host of factors that can affect the kind of teaching that we see as well. So those could be things like the curriculum. They could be things like the students in the classroom. They could be things like the leadership in the school. They could be like things like the other colleagues that are in the classrooms, that are in the schools. There's just a tremendous number of factors that affect the quality of teaching that occurs within a classroom that include the teacher but are not limited to the teacher.
Sorting all of this out sounds as though it would be very difficult and time-consuming. How can this translate into realistic evaluation?
Well, I think that, you know, you're hitting an essential tension here. If the evaluation system is simply to call out who's a good teacher and who's not, then I think there's a tendency to say, well, can we have some efficient methods that can do that calling out? But if we want to have systems that actually help us understand what's going on and contribute to an understanding of how we might improve the teachers, the teaching, and the system that supports that teaching, then I do think we are going to have to invest a bit more to build the capacity, not just of the teachers, but of the people who actually carry out those evaluations, the administrators, senior teachers, if that's where we go.
How do we deal with this?
One of the things is we have to have a clear understanding of what good quality teaching is. And one of the things that we're finding in our research is that the typical observer comes into classrooms and looks at certain features of the classrooms. It's easier to look at things like student behavior. It's easier to look at, is the classroom well organized? Do kids seem busy at their desks? And we find in many, many classrooms that's the case. What we find that is less frequent is the idea that kids are actually engaged in more deep reasoning about content, that they're doing problem solving and analysis, that they're engaged in making arguments and that there are feedback loops between teachers and students. And so this level of cognitive engagement, not only is it less frequent in the classrooms, but people have a much more difficult time seeing that. If the systems, if administrators don't have a good sense of what strong teaching is in different subject areas, then we run the risk that we only focus on sort of traditional classroom management techniques, which are necessary but not sufficient to have the kind of learning that's going to support the kind of high achievement levels that we'd like to have for all children.
It sounds as though your observers are going to need careful training in special protocols.
Each protocol actually brings a different lens on how we observe teaching. And one of the things we're studying in the MET project, as well as other projects, is how different lenses have different values about what is important in teaching and the kind of different stories they tell us about what's going on in the classroom. It's not that one is right or one is wrong, but they do give us different perspectives. And one of the things that you'd like to see in districts and states is some level of agreement about what is valued so that kids in different schools and teachers in different schools are held to the same general expectations of what quality teaching is.
I understand you're also trying to develop a measure with questions or items for evaluating the kind of knowledge that you think leads to quality teaching.
The project we work on in MET specifically is the idea of content knowledge for teaching. And this work grows out of research that was done at the University of Michigan, in which we are trying to examine the idea that there is a body of knowledge that is not straight content knowledge that the average educated person in a field has, but that there is a specialized body of knowledge that is important for teachers to have that is certainly related to the idea of pedagogical content knowledge. It's the idea of understanding what ideas might be difficult for students, understanding how to introduce concepts to students, to be able to analyze the work that students do. And so this is another set of measures that we're looking at, and we do that as part of the MET project.
Ah, I see. So in order to find out what content knowledge teachers need, how do you go about doing that?
Well, what we start out with really is doing some real examination of teachers. We look at videos. We try to identify what we call tasks of teaching. What is it that teachers actually do in classrooms, and how do they make use of knowledge of content? So we when we present students with the idea of, say, fractions in mathematics, we see where students may be having conceptual difficulties. We see when they represent fractions in more and less effective kinds of ways. We see how teachers have to interpret non-standard kinds of expressions that kids articulate or write down. And all of those things are the kinds of things that provide sort of fodder for developing items. So we look to have people who help develop these tasks as folks who have deep teaching knowledge as well as deep content knowledge. And it's the intersection of those that make this different than traditional forms of content knowledge testing that has often been used and is currently used in such things as teacher licensure.
What are some key points you want the audience to remember about teacher evaluation?
The belief systems that people have in moving towards more rigorous evaluation processes assume some particular theories of action. And what I mean by that is we say that when people, if we carry out evaluations in particular ways, we will have certain outcomes that will be improve education in particular kinds of ways. So if we make different hiring decisions or retention decisions, if we report out results in different kinds of ways, all of these are assumed to have certain kinds of effects. And I think those are issues that really, these theories of actions really need to be tested. Because there are going to be, as in any kind of significant kind of intervention like this, there will be different sorts of consequences, some of them intended and some of them unintended. So there is the theory of action, and then there are the measures themselves. And the measures themselves, whether it's value-added, whether it is observations, all of these things are very much early in their development and not completely understood. The quality control and the reliability of these measures is still very much in need of understanding and development and improvement. And so I would urge caution before committing whole hog and sort of locking into a system, that we understand that these things are developing, that we need to move ahead, but we need to move ahead in ways that don't lock us into systems that will ultimately be disappointing. So one of the things when I talk to policymakers and some of my colleagues talk to policymakers is we often urge that we move to piloting some of these systems within districts and states to really examine how these theories of action are playing out, because we don't understand them fully, and we want to make sure that we execute processes in ways that will, in fact, lead to the kinds of results that we want to have.
We've been talking to Drew Jatomer, Distinguished Researcher at Educational Testing Service, Director of the Understanding Teacher Quality Center, and a member of the Gates Foundation project team. This is Examining Education. Our topic today is teacher evaluation. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. Our second guest is Thomas Kane, Professor of Education and Economics at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Director of the Methods of Effective Teaching Project for the Gates Foundation. Can you give us an overview of the Gates Foundation project you're currently directing, the measures of teacher effectiveness?
We began last school year. We're working with 3,000 teacher volunteers in six different school districts. So teachers signed up voluntarily to participate in this project because they know how vacuous the current evaluation system is. The six districts that we're working in are New York City, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, Hillsborough County, Florida, which is Tampa, Memphis, Tennessee, Dallas, and Denver are the six different school districts where we're actively collecting data. So we started last year. This year is the second year. And we're now considering whether we may do another year with a subset of the teachers. Just, you know, rather than all 3,000, we may just try to follow a subset of about 400 teachers for another year.
You recently put out a preliminary report. Can you tell us about it?
We just put out a preliminary report in December, which summarized the one aspect of the data collection that we had back at that point, and that was the student perceptions. So in higher education, that's the way faculty are evaluated. That's the way I get feedback from my students every semester. And so we wanted to see to what extent that might be feasible in K-12 as well. So we had a report back in December where we reported on the degree to which student perceptions of what's going on in the classroom are related to student achievement gains. The interesting thing there was, so when people hear the general idea, could we ask students for some feedback? Naturally, people wonder, hey, wait a minute, would this just be a popularity contest? But it's only a popularity contest if you just ask questions about a teacher's popularity. Instead, if you ask more pointed questions like, do you agree, disagree, we use time well in this class and we don't waste time, when I turn in homework, my teacher gives me useful feedback that helps me improve. When you ask questions like that, you're getting at specific aspects of practice, time management or feedback on student work, that if they prove to be related to student achievement, and our early results suggested that they were, would give teachers some specific things to work on.
Okay, so one of your measures is getting student feedback through these questionnaires. That sounds pretty easy to administer. I imagine, though, that just as when college students evaluate their professors, precautions to ensure privacy have to be taken, thus someone other than the professor administers the questionnaire, the same thing must be true in the public school classroom?
We had to take similar precautions in K-12 just to try to ensure that both the teacher and the student were comfortable that the results, were being treated confidentially. So another measure that we're using is classroom observation. Now, it's hard to imagine trying to provide feedback to a teacher on the work they do without actually observing what's going on in the classroom and try to provide some feedback that's specifically focused on classroom practice. There have been a number of rubrics that have been developed over the years for guiding somebody walking into a classroom to look for specific things. And rather than pick one and decide that, and test that, we collected videos 4 times last year in each of these teachers' classrooms and then 4 times again this year, and are having those videos rated using each of 6 different rubrics. So, we'll be testing to what extent were the scores or the ratings or the feedback based on each of those rubrics related to other things like student perceptions and student achievement gains.
When Drew Jatomer from Educational Testing Service and I talked earlier about observations, he talked about the different perceptions one observer might have who was looking at a group of highly involved students in the front of the classroom, while another observer might be looking at a group of off-task students at the back of the room. So how were the videos done?
There were actually 2 different cameras. One was a high-resolution fixed camera that focused on the board or wherever the teacher was going to be spending most of the class, and then a 2nd panoramic video that captures everything in the classroom. So, if somebody wanted to watch what the students at the front of the class were saying, they could navigate to that portion of the video. If they wanted to watch what students in the back of the class were doing, they could navigate to that portion. And the whole point of that is, how could you collect video in a classroom without having an adult standing in the middle of the classroom pointing a video camera that would both distract students and be, economically, infeasible? So this panoramic camera is intended to provide a low-cost way of observing in a classroom that doesn't, require an adult operator.
So you're saying that these two cameras do not require any operator?
No, you roll them into the room. That's the other important thing is they're temporarily in the room, and a teacher knows when they're there, and a teacher knows when they're not. So they're on they're about the size of a transparency projector from a classroom, and they're on a little cart and are wheeled in and wheeled out.
I'll bet it certainly made teachers more comfortable knowing they weren't going to be videotaped continually. Now, in terms of observation protocols, how much training do the observers need?
Depends on the rubric. Some of these are more complicated than others. But typically the training takes place over a few days. And then at the end of the training, folks are, and in fact, each day that they're scoring video, they're given some pre-scored videos and asked to rate them. And only if they're able to return scores that are close to the pre-scored ratings are they allowed to, you know, continue on.
Right. Well, now, all of this, though, seems to depend on your third measure, because you were saying, how does this correlate with actual student achievement, and how are you measuring that?
So we're measuring it a couple of different ways. One way is to use whatever the state test is in the site, in the six different sites are in six different states, each with their own assessment. So we'll be looking at student growth on those assessments. So how did students in a particular classroom do at the end of the year relative to other students in the district that had similar scores in the prior spring? So it's all relative to similar students on the state test. But those are, as I'm sure you'll hear from some of the other folks on this show, have been subject to some controversy. So we are supplementing the state tests with some additional tests that focus more on students' conceptual understanding. So in English language arts, we used an open-ended assessment. So students are given a short reading passage, and rather than being given a series of multiple choice questions after the passage, they're asked to provide some short answer responses to questions about that reading passage. Math, we're using an assessment called the Balanced Assessment in Math, which requires not just, you know, computational skills, but it includes some open-ended items that require students to demonstrate their conceptual understanding. For instance, you know, coming up with an algebraic expression to describe an answer rather than just offer a numeric answer.
But now, wouldn't there be a difference in grades? In other words, in the lower grades, there are constantly people coming in and out, other adults working with kids, as opposed to, say, high school, where maybe you do have more of a self-contained classroom.
So, I mean, that's one of the striking things is despite the fact that there are lots of influences on a individual child's learning, there are very big differences in student achievement gains in different teachers' classrooms. So even in the same school, there can be large differences in the gain that a kid with a given test score will have, depending on, you know, which classroom that they're in. And we've known that for decades. The crazy thing is that we've not developed additional tools like classroom, like a meaningful classroom observation, or like student feedback, by identifying the content knowledge that's required for teaching, we've not been able to provide feedback on exactly what it is that's going on there. Instead, we leave it to teachers to sort of close their doors and do the best they can by themselves in private, and anything that they've developed over the course of their career retires with them at the end.
So, using this new tool, the Student Perception Survey, I gather from your report that you've discovered the importance of time management and classroom management.
It's not the only thing that matters, but when we ask kids these questions, we could then look and see which of the student responses were most related to student achievement gains. And among the top five questions most highly correlated with student achievement gains were, do you agree, disagree, we use time well in this class and we don't waste time, the students in this class behave the way the teacher wants them to, and other questions like, our teacher expects us to correct our mistakes in this class.
I gather you were also surprised at the low correlation between time spent on preparing for the state tests and achievement.
The interesting thing was that while student responses to those items were positively related to student achievement gains on the state tests, they were among the lowest correlations that we saw. So I think what we're learning is that it's excellent instruction that is most associated with student achievement gains, and that actually is one of the most powerful lessons that we're learning from this, that in theory the classroom observations and the student perceptions and the student achievement gains would all be giving you wildly different answers. But actually, in practice, there's a lot more alignment among these things than the political debate sometimes would leave you to believe.
So it's not that you want to substitute value-added scores for direct observations of teachers?
Of course, you'd want to have both. You'd want to be able to observe what's going on in the classroom, but each of those classroom observations is by itself going to be a noisy measure. We need to supplement it with as many different new pieces of information as possible. Mm-hmm. And in this Measures of Effective Teaching study, we've tried to say, make sure that we had something on students' relationship to the teacher, the students' relationship to the content through the value-added measures, and then teachers' relationship to the content. So rather than have it all rely on one or another, the goal is to find a set of these things that are aligned.
Thank you for giving us a clearer idea about what the MET Project is all about. You're listening to Examining Education. Our topic today is teacher evaluation. We've been speaking to our second guest, Thomas Kane, Professor of Education and Economics at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Director of the Methods of Effective Teaching Project for the Gates Foundation. This is Examining Education. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley, and we're examining the topic of teacher evaluation. Our last guest is Jesse Rothstein, who is an associate professor of public policy and economics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also the author of a commissioned review in January of this year that was quite critical of the preliminary report issued the month before by the Gates Foundation's Methods of Effective Teaching project. Before we talk about your review of this project, can you first tell us about your own background in terms of your interest in and experience with teacher evaluation?
Sure. I'm an economist. I specialize in working with large data sets and trying to learn something from them. So I have no experience with traditional forms of teacher evaluation that involve sitting in the backs of classrooms and watching what is a good teacher. I leave that to people who know more about the specifics of pedagogy than I do. But I do have a fair amount of experience in trying to figure out what we can and can't learn from large-scale data sets. And in particular, I got interested in what are known as value-added models a few years ago. These are models that let you that try to attribute student test score gains as observed from the end of 1 year to the end of the next year, and try to attribute those to what contribution is due to the teacher versus what contribution is due to other inputs such as the student's own family background or the school or other factors. One of the preconditions for being able to do that decomposition that we would like to do is that students are randomly assigned to classrooms. And when I got interested in these models, the first thing that I think one should do when trying to evaluate one of these models is try to assess whether that precondition holds. And so I started looking at data from the state of North Carolina, and what I discovered is that students are pretty importantly not randomly assigned to classrooms. And as a consequence, there are big differences, for example, in students' fourth grade test scores and third grade test scores between fifth grade classrooms. So that is, there are some teachers who get students who had high scores in fourth grade and high gains from third to fourth grade. There are other teachers who get students who had low scores or low gains in those grades. Because those gains and those scores are predictive of fifth grade outcomes, that suggests that these models can't successfully distinguish what portion of the gain from fourth to fifth grade is due to the teacher versus what portion is due to other factors.
So you're saying that without random assignment, there are going to be systematic biases in the results. This then must play a big part in your criticisms of the value-added measure in the Gates Met project.
Actually, the criticism of non-random assignment is something that I mentioned in my review, but I don't think it's a first-order problem here. I don't think it's one of the primary issues with the Methods of Effective Teaching project. I think there are several aspects of the project, some of them complete and some of them not yet complete. One aspect of the project is that they are going to randomly assign students to classrooms and compare the random assignment estimates of teachers' value added with estimates that are obtained without random assignment. The advantage of random assignment is that it eliminates that problem that I just mentioned, which is that student assignments can lead to biases in teachers' estimated value added. Mm-hmm. And so that comparison will tell us how serious the problem is. But that part of the project isn't finished yet. And so what we have now are measures of value added from a non-random assignment regime. And so there's some bias in them due to student assignments that we don't know how big that is.
So then, because we don't yet know how much bias non-random assignment introduces, you're urging us to be cautious in using the results of value-added measurement?
I would say that it's limited in ways, and that suggests that we should be cautious in the way we use it. But it may still be better than the alternative, as long as it's used appropriately.
Wasn't there another limitation of the value-added measure that you said you noticed after the study came out and that you thought was one of the most important findings? It was a result you noticed that you found surprising?
Well, one of the results in the Met study is that which teachers we judge as having good effects on student achievement depends very importantly on which measure of student achievement we use. The Met study calculated value-added measures based on two different tests, one the normal state test that the kids were taking anyway, and the second, a more demanding test that was more aimed at conceptual understanding rather than rote multiple choice responses. And what they found is that the teachers who did very well on one measure tended not to do so well on the other measure, and vice versa. That there's a fairly weak correlation between a teacher's measured value added for the state test and the measured value added for the alternative test. That suggests that even if we decide student achievement is the right measure, we've got to be very careful about defining what components of student achievement we care about.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're only going to create incentives to raise the ones that we're actually measuring. And it turns out that the teachers who raise the ones we're measuring aren't the ones who raise the ones we aren't measuring.
So there wasn't a correlation. Because when I spoke to Thomas Kane, I thought he was saying that all of the measures all nicely dovetailed.
There's a correlation, but it's not a very strong correlation. You would have wanted that correlation to be something like 1, or given that there's some measurement error in these measures, to be, say, 0.7 or 0.8. In practice, it's under 0.5.
Uh-huh.
And so that suggests that there are real important differences, that they dovetail somewhat, but not nearly as much as I think we would have expected.
I believe you've also written that we need other information.
So one thing that you might be referring to is that it's not clear whether test score-based measures are giving us the same information or different information as the other ways we could assess teachers. And the Met Project is considering three ways of assessing teachers. There's the value-added approach. There are classroom observations. The core of the Met Project is that they are videotaping thousands of teachers teaching their lessons, and they're going to hire people to score those videotapes and to assign scores to each teacher, saying this was good instruction, this was less good instruction, based on those videotapes.
I noticed your report mentioned specific protocols being used. I'm wondering how much training observers will need to be able to score these observations.
One of the things that we will learn from the Met Project, once those classroom observation data are available, is how feasible it is to implement a protocol like this at a mass scale.
Did you have reservations about their other measures, for example, such as student questionnaires?
Again, like as I mentioned, all of these measures are limited, and questionnaires are limited in somewhat different ways and somewhat similar ways to value added. Among the different ways is it's not clear that what students are rewarding is effective teaching. There's some evidence from the college context that what students reward when they fill out questionnaires is not effective teaching, but easy grading.
Mm-hmm.
So, as best as we can tell, the teachers who get the best student evaluations in a couple of college studies are those who give high grades, and their students typically don't do less well in future courses. So it looks like they haven't done such a great job of teaching. So that's one concern about student evaluations. A second concern is more specific to the pre-secondary education system. We're talking about using these measures to evaluate elementary, middle, and high school teachers. It strikes me as a dangerous idea to tell 13-year-olds that they're going to fill out an evaluation of their teacher and that evaluation will determine whether the teacher is fired or not. I'm not sure I trust college students to do that, and most colleges don't put that much weight on student evaluations for that reason. But 13-year-olds are particularly likely, I think, to cause mischief if given the opportunity. One of the things I mentioned in my review is that a lot of these measures are going to perform very differently in a research context where they're just being studied than they are going to in a context where they're actually being used to make high-stakes decisions. And so, for example, I would expect different sorts of mischief from the 13-year-olds in a research study than I would if they know that their answers have real consequences.
Well, actually, I think you mentioned that all of the measures in a high-stakes situation would be subject to corruption.
Absolutely. And so my research, as I mentioned, has focused on the value-added measures and on the sensitivity of those measures to how students are assigned to classrooms. In research studies where there are no stakes attached to it, I would assume that students are assigned to classrooms based on educational considerations. But once you start to put stakes on the value-added measures, teachers will have a strong incentive to lobby for student assignments that will help their measure.
Mm-hmm.
No teacher is going to happily agree to teach students who are predictably going to show low gains and will therefore depress the teacher's value-added score if they know that they could be fired as a result.
Right. Well, are there any measures that wouldn't be susceptible of this?
No. I think one of the lessons from long history of social science research is that anytime you put stakes on a measure, that measure is going to be corrupted. And have one of the conclusions that people have drawn from that fact is that you want a system that doesn't put too much weight on any single measure, particularly on measures that are more susceptible to gaming.
So in then when I ask you, how would you go about measuring teacher effectiveness, what would you do?
I think, again, the research isn't done yet, so I wouldn't say that we know the right answer, but I think it's pretty safe to predict that the best system is going to combine multiple measures, putting moderate weight on lots of them, avoiding mechanical rules where you just plug in the numbers and it yields the decision, fire this teacher or don't fire this teacher, and leaving some human discretion in the system.
Mm-hmm.
I strongly suspect that the right system is going to have a pretty important weight put on subjective judgments by trained supervisors. And that's something that we haven't really done very much in the education system relative to other occupations to date, partly because we tend not to have very many supervisors in the school. There are rules of thumb about how many supervisors you need for each worker, and one of the rules of thumb is that you want something like one supervisor for every 5 or 10 workers, where that supervisor is spending all of their time on supervision tasks, on personnel evaluation and that sort of thing. That's far, far higher ratio of supervisors to workers than you see in most education contexts, where you tend to have one principal for several dozen teachers, where that principal not only has to do personnel evaluation, but also has to keep the school building running and facilities clean and deal with student discipline problems and all sorts of other things. What I think the Gates Foundation is interested in using these measures for, at least in part, is to support salary and retention decisions. That is, that they want to be able to give higher salaries to effective teachers, lower salaries to less effective teachers.
So how would you go about trying to improve teacher effectiveness?
I think it is a hard problem. I think that probably if we really believe that teacher effectiveness is an extremely important lever, and I think there's some evidence, although not overwhelming evidence, that that's true, I think we do have to decide that does involve a decision that we're going to devote more of our resources to teacher supervision and evaluation. And I think one of the dangerous aspects of the public debate about this seems to me to be that a view that we can do all of this on the cheap, that this is just free, this is just an easy answer lying out there that won't require any sacrifices. And I don't think that's right. I think if we want to be serious about raising teacher quality, we're going to have to put resources into that problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, how accountable do you think teachers should be held for student achievement?
In an ideal world, I think it makes sense to hold teachers accountable for student achievement. In a less ideal world where our measures are easily corrupted, then it may be better not to hold teachers accountable than to hold them accountable to bad measures.
Mm-hmm.
I think we don't know yet how corruptible the measures are, but I guess what we do know is that there are very few white-collar occupations where there is strong accountability for easily measured results. Typically, white-collar jobs, the output isn't easy to measure, and so we tend not to have strong teeth in our accountability systems. And I suspect that's where we'll end up with teachers as well.
Tell me again, repeat, where will we wind up?
Yes. With a system where there's some accountability, but there's not a whole lot of firing that goes on, and there's not a lot of dependence on mechanical rules.
I see.
If you look at other white collar occupations, there aren't very many workers who are fired for bad performance. There may be some portion of the pay that depends on individual performance, but it tends to be fairly small, and that tends to depend on a mixture of a number of measures. And I think that we'll end up with something similar, where a small amount of salary perhaps depends on performance measures, but that's not based on any single performance measure, or doesn't put inordinate amount of weight on any single performance measure.
Well, I noticed in your study, I think you talked about being in favor of pilot studies.
Yes, I think as I've mentioned, we don't really know very much right now about what works and what doesn't, about how reliable and how gameable all of these measures are. And the question, I think that we've done a lot of study of these measures, but all in context where they're not really being used. It seems to me that the main question that remains to be answered is, how much will these measures be corrupted when we start to put stakes on them? And the only way to learn that is to try out pilot studies where we put stakes on them, see what happens. Been a couple of those done thus far, but not nearly enough.
What? How would you go about designing a pilot study?
Well, so one I can mention one of the ones that was already finished. This was the POINT study done by a group out of Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. And what they did was they randomly assigned participating teachers either to the normal salary schedule or to receive bonuses for having high value added scores. And so teachers were eligible for bonuses of up to, I believe, $15,000 for achieving very high value added scores. And the teachers who were eligible for the bonuses were what we wanted to see was that the eligibility for these bonuses led them to achieve, in fact, higher value added than the teachers who weren't eligible. But in fact, there was no difference in the value added of teachers who were eligible and those who weren't eligible for value added for bonuses. And that suggests that at least there aren't at least the factors that are under the teacher's control in the short run, they don't really have the ability to change their behavior so as to raise their value added score.
It's interesting. It's a little bit like extrinsic, intrinsic motivation. What's most effective?
Exactly. Exactly. Now, the people who argue for using value added have a response to that study, and they say that the main goal of value added is to change who it is that's in the teaching profession. That what we want to do is use incentive pay and other policies to attract better teachers into the profession and to retain them more, and to filter out the less effective teachers. And a study like the POINT experiment can't get at that because it's a short-run study that's based on the teachers who are already there. Studying retention and recruitment requires a much longer-run study, and nobody's quite cracked the nut of how to do that study yet, but it's something we clearly need to do.
Thanks, Jesse, for helping us understand how complex and confounding teacher evaluation can be and how untested and unreliable some of these measures may be. That was Jesse Rothstein, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of California. Our topic for today was teacher evaluation. Listeners who want to explore this topic further will find additional details and links on our website, examineducation.org. We encourage you also to send in suggestions for future topics. Our program series has been produced with audio help from Mike Pritchard and Jason Croft. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley.